Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. I'm joined here in the studio by co-host Bill McHenry. Good morning, Bill. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Ron. Really well today. Very, very hot here in Atlanta, though.
That's a scorcher for sure. Well, Bill, you know, on Launch, we feature innovators, entrepreneurs, related industries, providing our listeners with the opportunity to learn from the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. You know, this morning we're going to be featuring Nick Brannon of the Brannon Law Office. But before we get started, Bill, could you thank today's sponsor?
Sure, Ron. Today our sponsor is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
That's super. Well, Bill, you know Nick real well. Why don't you give us some highlights about Bill?
Well, Ron, Nick has been friends with me for several years. He is involved with all the inventor and entrepreneur clubs in Wisconsin. He has his own law business in just north of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Fond du Lac is about an hour north. And Ron is one of the good guys.
That's good. So what's the first question that you'd like to ask Nick?
Well, Nick, one of the things I'd like to ask you is when you started out your business, why did you go into business for yourself?
Well, I knew early on that I wanted to be a business owner. It's one of the things that my grandfather did, my father did, and it seemed natural to me. You know, there's this illusion if you go to work for a big company that there's stability and safety. And I learned early on that that's not the case. And so I wanted to stake out my own future.
What was the scariest part about going into business?
Well, obviously the unknown's scary, and you know, I tried to minimize my fear. I did some things. You know, people talk about business plans and things like that, and I prepared one. It wasn't a formal one, but I tried to project expenses, made a guess at income, and I set a bunch of money aside from savings to cover those expenses for the first 6 months or a year, so that I wouldn't have pressure to produce right away. And doing that, you know, allowed me to overcome my fear of the unknown because I knew I had a good product. I just knew I had to get out there first.
Well, Nick, you know, I really admire you, you know, for going into business for yourself. I worked at one of those large corporations for 32 years, and I went there for the safety and security. And I always was amazed at people that went into business for themselves, wondering how did they have the courage to do that? How did they have the skills to do that? You know, because, you know, I was just an employee for 32 years, and it wasn't until I retired that I actually went into business for myself. So my hat's off.
Let me give you an analogy of the flip side. About 12 years ago, the week that my wife and I were to be married, her father was laid off from General Motors the week of our wedding. And he had been an employee there for must have been 30 years at the time. And that just really drove home the point, at least to me, that when you least expect it, you know, terrible things can happen to your career. And that just really drove it home for me.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's kind of the illusion of security working at a large corporation. But I think I've seen statistics that I guess for the last 50 years, the number of large corporations has constantly been shrinking, okay? And most of the businesses out there are small and medium-sized businesses, not the big behemoths.
Nick, I also remember you telling me that I'll quote you, failure is not an option.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't. My wife stays home, and so I have to be the sole breadwinner. And that's fine. It's a burden I'll take because I know I'm in control of my destiny. And I just feel comfortable in putting that product out there. I put a lot of thought into realistic expectations, and I think that's something that people going into or considering going into business for themselves ought to consider is what are realistic odds of success. You know, however that's quantified, I don't know. But how likely is this dream to come true?
Yeah, I know the American Bar Association put out an article, a little pamphlet for entrepreneurs, and in there they've got a statement that the most common misconception or underestimation that entrepreneurs make is they think it's going to take less time and less money than it really does. It always takes more time and more money to actually get traction to where you've got a good, viable business.
Well, I think that's probably true. It's certainly true for me. And I found that when I went out on my own, I worked more and made less. But that's fine because I was happier.
I agree with that.
That's for sure.
Well, you know, when Bill says, you know, the failure is not an option, I guess you've heard the story of, I guess it was the Roman general when he went to England and he did made this famous statement of, gentlemen, burn your ships. Had you heard that story?
No, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Roman general. They land on the banks of England, and as they look up on the horizon, you know, all of the warriors in the world, you know, show up and getting ready to come charging down the hill. And he turned around and looked at the men. He could start to see fear in their eyes. And so he instructed the folks to burn their ships. So they either had to fight and win or die, okay? And I know that was my attitude when I, you know, launched my own business was, to, you know, I was going to make it succeed or I was going to die trying, you know.
Right. I mean, at some point, you have to know when to pull the plug. And I'm thankful I never had to come to that. And part of that's because I planned not to produce a lot of revenue the first year or two. I just knew instinctively that was going to be the toughest few years. And so before I started, I accumulated a good deal of savings. And I didn't go out and, you know, blow it on big expensive purchases, and I didn't waste it on a ton of advertising because I knew that wasn't going to be what draws people to me. But I still had that safety net. And so when I say failure is not an option, yeah, it's true, but it's kind of a fabrication because if I never really, really grab traction at what's not the end of the world, I could always go back and do what I did before.
Nick, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how you researched your competition and how you differentiated your patent business versus some of the ones, say, in Milwaukee?
Well, it's actually a fairly tight-knit community, and I wouldn't even necessarily consider just Milwaukee my competition per se. You know, all patent attorneys deal in federal law, so pretty much any place geographically is competition. Now, with that said, obviously Milwaukee's probably the largest competition. And what I realized as an associate was the vast majority of firms bill in what I call traditional methods, straight hourly. And that's fine. It's exceedingly fair. But what it is a little unsettling for the inventors and the entrepreneurs. And my twist was I'm going to offer flat fee services when I can. And that way people know, oh, it's going to cost exactly this much. And people really, really liked that. Another thing I did is I said, well, I don't need to hit the biggest companies as clients because there's a lot more little guys than there are big guys. And if I can make the little guys happy and do a good job at a fair price, they'll tell their friends, and then those friends will tell those friends. And that's exactly what happened.
I'm sitting here laughing because Ron and I had dinner last night, and I asked him the very same question, and that was the exact answers he gave me.
Yep, that was really smart of you, Nick, because I find that, you know, a lot of the large law firms, the last thing they want to do is deal with the little guys. They're always going after the big fish.
Which is fine. It works for them. You know, I'm certainly not going to criticize that. You know, if I would break down how new business comes in, referrals from existing clients is by far the biggest one. A smaller percentage, but it's still significant, is referrals from friends of mine at some big firms for exactly the reason you said. There's a client that's probably going to have one project, and they're not thoroughly flush with money, and it's not worth the firm's time to engage them. And the client certainly doesn't want to pay those prices. You know, I found I can make a perfectly good living charging a flat fee that's about a third less than what the big firms charge. And that's my niche, if you will.
Yeah, and it's an excellent niche. You know, I worked at the phone company for 32 years, and towards the end of that career, we had a product that was called Measured Service, where we thought that we could charge customers, you know, by the minute for making local calls. And the customers absolutely hated it. They really did. They didn't like being billed, you know, by the minute for a local call. They wanted the security of flat rate pricing. And I think that transfers. Right. I think that's one of the things people hate about it. Most attorneys is you call them for 1 minute and you get billed for a minimum of 15, you know, and you just had a simple question. So,
I picked up some of my largest clients for that reason alone, was the perception of being nickel and dimed. Now, I said that billing hourly or in the tenth of an hour increment, I guess, is the most common, is exceedingly fair, because it is. You pay for someone's time. But there's still the unknown. And there was a firm out east on the East Coast with a client out here in Wisconsin that I don't know how they ultimately engaged that firm, but every time they sent an email, they got a 0.5 charge, 0.5 hours. And every time the attorney responded, it was 0.5. So that firm was operating on a 0.5 minimum. And so for what took maybe 10 minutes overall, they were getting charged an hour. And geographically, the East Coast is among the highest.
And that
they're easily double of what the Midwest charges.
And that was for emails. I never heard of
Correct.
Such a thing. Oh, wow.
Nick promised me you won't send me a bill like that.
I said, let's just eliminate all charges for telephone calls and all charges for emails. We will bill you when we perform a service, and we'll tell you what the bill is going to be in advance. And that's just worked wonderfully well, because most problems are small problems, or most questions are easy ones to answer. And I just went on a whim and said, I don't want to discourage people from calling and asking those questions, because if they're happy and they perceive a good value, they will tell their friends.
Nick, tell me a little bit how you network. One of the things that I picked up from you when we first met years ago is that you're a big networker. Tell our audience what you do to network.
Well, there's no magic to it. It's actually kind of simplistic. I go out and I try not to be a knob. You know, it sounds like a simple answer, but if someone has a question, you answer it. And you answer it honestly and as quickly as you can, and you don't get pretentious. You know, I go to some entrepreneur and inventor clubs around the state, and sometimes I'm lucky enough to present to them. Other times I just go as an audience member. And I don't come in on an ivory tower. You know, I'm just a person that goes to a meeting. And it works.
Yeah, that's
right. The vast majority of people at the meetings never hire me. And that's fine, because it's fun for me. So I'm still getting something out of it.
Yeah, there's John White of the Practicing Law Institute, PLI, you know, was a patent examiner, and now he's a patent attorney, and he's been teaching the course on how to pass the patent bar for quite a few years. And his opening statement that he makes at the beginning of each class is, he says, what kind of person becomes a patent attorney? And there's usually silence, and then he gives the answer. He says, the people that don't have personality to do tax work. And most of the patent attorneys that I've met really fit that. But then there are folks, you know, that actually have personality and they're a regular person. And that's the ones that, you know, individual inventors and the owners of small business really gravitate to, because you're a likable person.
I think that could be right. If you look at the career track to become a patent attorney, it's pretty narrow and focused. First of all, you have to be an engineer or a scientist. And then you have to decide somewhere along the line that you don't want to be an engineer or a scientist, so you go to law school. And it's a very, very narrow subset of law school. Most engineers that go to law school become patent attorneys. You know, they don't decide to do family law or criminal defense law. The sole reason is to be a patent attorney, and that's certainly true with me. And so I guess it's probably fair to say that they all have similar personality traits.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty funny, because, you know, when you think about tax attorneys, now those people are really dry.
Well, maybe. Have you ever gone to a party and looked forward to seeing the person that says, I'm an IRS tax attorney?
Never. Never.
Usually not the most most popular folks at the party.
Yeah, it's similar to when I was working at a telephone company. The people from auditing, if the people from auditing ever showed up, says, "Hi, I'm from auditing, and I'm here to help you." And we're like, right.
Nick, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some patent questions. What are some of the challenges you see currently facing small businesses in protecting their intellectual property?
Well, I'd have to say the biggest one, obviously, is going to be finances. It just simply costs money to operate in this arena. The second one, probably, second challenge would be knowledge. And there's this misconception that if you have a patent, it's some kind of magical document that is going to shield you from everything. And likewise, there's this misconception that someone else has a patent that shuts you out completely from the industry, which of course is untrue. And so I'd say confusion as to what's protectable and what's not.
Okay. Well, Nick, you know, Johnny Carson was the host of the Tonight Show, and what a lot of people don't realize is he actually sat on a little cushion all those years he was the host of the Tonight Show, and there was embroidered a message on that cushion that he read every night just before he sat down. And what the message was, it says, it's all in the timing, okay? So what's the best time to actually talk to a patent attorney?
There's not really a correct answer for every situation, but I guess I'll illustrate a couple rules of thumb, if you will. When you believe that you have a full concept and you want to research whether it's patentable or even want to determine whether it's worth pursuing at all, that's probably a good time. Certainly, before you make any types of public disclosures, when I say that, I mean take it to a trade show, make a prototype, throw it up on eBay, something like that. Before that type of event, you'll want to talk to a patent attorney. Reason I say that is if you're concerned at all with international rights, then an application needs to be filed prior to that public disclosure. If you're only concerned about the U.S., there is a one-year grace period, but still it still may be advantageous to file before the public disclosure. Likewise, before you commercialize a product, not so much from a patenting standpoint on your own end, but I would imagine it'd be a pretty severe blow to a business, especially a startup, if you prototype, market, package, distribute, get everything lined up just to find out a competitor's patent is in place. And it just could just devastate the business. And so before you take a large expense, I think it's worthwhile to probably see if you have some freedom to operate.
Okay, so once you determine that you've got freedom to operate, you know, what's the odds of success that if you've come up with a new widget that it's actually going to succeed in the marketplace and actually get a patent?
Well, you ask two questions. And one of those questions is it patentable? And the other is it going to be a commercial success? Patent attorneys are really, really good at answering the first and really, really poor at answering the second question.
Okay.
If we do a patent search and we do a thorough search, we can tell you have good odds, fair odds, or poor odds of success in obtaining a patent. But the question becomes far more complicated and one that patent attorneys aren't really equipped to deal with when you say, is it going to be a commercial success? You know, because we don't know. You know, I don't know if anyone knows, but certainly the patent attorney doesn't know.
Okay.
So I might be able to say, that's a product I would like to buy, or that's a product I probably would not like to buy, but that's about the extent of it.
Yeah, and you're a consumer group of one, right?
Right. And I may even be a consumer group that has no reason to buy the product. For example, if you're an inventor and you've invented a new piece of industrial machinery and it performs a specific function in that marketplace, you're going to sell to maybe one of 10 companies that use that type of industrial machinery. Well, I don't own one of those companies. I don't work in that field. So if you ask me if that's going to be successful in that field, I don't know. I can tell you generally, if it solves a problem if it's cost effective, if it improves efficiency or durability or does something that their consumer wants to do, it stands a reasonable chance of success. If it only works just as good as the existing art, but it costs more, I'd say your odds of success are extremely low. If it costs less and works better, your odds go up.
Yeah.
But I think you still have to consider who your consumers are.
Yeah, I know.
Who's going to actually take money out of their pocket and put it in yours? And what would they want to do?
Yeah, I know that if you'd asked me if the Snuggie was going to be a huge market success, I would have said no, and I'd been dead wrong, you know.
Right, right. But if you asked my 7-year-old at the time, that would have been the greatest thing ever.
Right. Obviously, I was right, not
just,
the target
just like
market.
A Happy Meal is still great.
That's true. That's true. Well, I remember one story about the fella that invented the commercial bread slicer. Got a patent for it and everything, and the patent expired, and he died before anybody was ever interested in actually employing the bread slicer and using it commercially. So he was way ahead of what the market needed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right. There is a timing issue for inventions, too. And some things would be great, but for the innovation. For example, way back in the 1900s, early 1900s, you know, if you would have asked people what they really wanted, they would have said a more comfortable saddle. It wouldn't necessarily have said, oh, I want a car.
That's right. That's yeah, true. I think Henry Ford said if he'd ask his customers what they wanted, they said faster horses.
Right. Right. So somehow having the ability to know what the consumers are going to want, not just today, but in the upcoming years, if you can figure that out, I think you've increased your odds of success.
Yeah, Steve Jobs is the only one that I know of that can do that consistently. Yeah,
that's for sure. Nick, what's the benefits of doing a provisional patent? And maybe you should explain the difference between the two types of patents.
Sure. Well, there's actually a provisional is the first step in a utility application process. The two main types of patents are design patents and utility patents. Design patents, the ornamental appearance, how it looks. The utility patent protects the structures and the functions, how and why it works. With that said, a provisional application is a placeholder. It's a cost and time delaying measure that is advantageous mostly to small companies or individual inventors because they can get to a patent pending status with the least amount of upfront capital. The provisional app will stay pending for a year. Within that 1 year, the applicant can and should make public disclosures, try to sell product, try to license or assign the invention, do everything that they would normally do with a regular pending application, but they can do it with less upfront investment. Because the sad fact is most inventions ultimately end up not making money. They're called losers, right? They put money in and they don't get any money back out. And if an individual is diligent, they'll take advantage of that 1 year provisional application pending period to diligently try to see if it's going to get traction. And if it does, they can have the confidence to move forward with the utility application. If it doesn't, they'll have to think long and hard about why it didn't. Does it just need more time, or is the market not going to embrace the idea? And if the market's not going to embrace the idea, they stop right there, and they've had limited, you know, financial exposure.
Well, you know, when you mentioned that most inventions don't make money, it reminds me of the joke about the definition for a boat, that a boat is a hole in the water into which you pour unlimited money. And unfortunately, a lot of inventions are that way. I think for every 99 inventions, you know, that fail, only about one of them succeeds.
Right, and yeah, I guess I don't know the statistic, but I do know that there's probably thousands of reasons why products don't succeed, The most obvious would be that that's just not a good idea. Or maybe the timing's wrong. Maybe the cost structure's wrong. I think sometimes there's a misconception that if you just apply for a patent, people will somehow find you and want to buy it, which is not true. It takes work. And I usually ask people, although I can't really answer it, but I ask anyways, is how are you going to make money on this? You know, what is your plan ultimately? Are you going to try to license it? Are you going to try to manufacture it yourself? If so, how are you going to distribute it? What stores are going to buy this? Because the stores are the ones that's going to pay you. The customers ultimately have to buy it from the stores. But if you can't get it on the shelves, it's not going to do you a lot of good.
Yeah, because...
And so having that conversation, even though I can't answer those questions, I think frames it in a light that allows the entrepreneurs to decide if it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, because I know a lot of inventors think that a patent's magic. You know, it's like like you said, that you have the patent and you know everybody comes to you. But you know, it's manufacturing, marketing, distribution, sales. That's really the key.
The most successful, or the category I've seen with the highest odds of success, are the small companies that have gone a long way down the process of product development before they apply for the patent, meaning they've already considered channels of trade. They have existing channels of trade, so they know they can pump the product out there. They have dedicated engineering, so they know the product works. They have dedicated accountants, so they know their cost structure. They know the competing products in the market. Oftentimes, these people will tell me the full state of the prior art prior to any type of patent search. And I say, Nick, here are the 10 patents we're worried about. Once all those unknowns become less unknown, their odds of success go up because they can put it right in the marketplace. Where it's really challenging, on the other hand, is when, say, I as an individual come up with a plumbing tool. Well, I'm not a plumber, but maybe I was doing something around my house, and I said, oh, it'd be really cool if there was a tool that did this. I'm not in that industry. I have no idea the state of the prior art. I don't have the ability to prototype myself. I don't know anything about injection molding or any of those processes. I don't have any products I'm selling in that industry. I have no channels of trade, no distribution, no packaging, no marketing. And for me, that's pretty daunting. And so the odds of success are necessarily low, unless I have unlimited funds, which, of course, I don't.
That's something. Well,
go ahead.
Nick, how long does this process take to actually get a patent, and what can an entrepreneur or product developer do while the application is pending?
Overall, the process is 2 to 4 years on average. It's a pretty wide window. As an example, within the last year, we've received correspondence from the patent office in as little as 9 months. On the long side, we've had applications we filed in 2006 that we're still waiting for an office action on.
Jeez.
So that's going on 4 years. In either case, once the application is pending, the applicant can and should try to execute their plan to either bring the product to market themselves or try to license it or assign it. Pending applications are sold all the time. It's really unwise to drag your feet just to wait until the patent issues or there's some resolution on the patent, just because that's a couple of years that you'll never get back.
Nick, one of the questions I get from entrepreneurs and inventors with my company is talk to me a little bit about licensing it versus trying to manufacture it. What's the difference in the profit or the loss I could make between the two?
Well, if you do it yourself, you have a lot greater responsibility and a lot greater investment you need to make as an individual. the potential reward is larger because you get all the profits. But the downside is enormous in that you have to front all the cost yourself, including inventory. So you have to make a whole bunch of products before you know if there's a buyer for them. On the other hand, you can license the idea to a third party, and what you'll gain is access to their distribution channels, their manufacturing expertise, their marketing. That party will take on all those responsibilities. What you will lose is potentially a good deal of money because you're going to get a royalty, which is a percentage, usually a small percentage of the profits. I say lose, but it's not really a loss because you know that going in, that in order to limit your downside exposure, you give up a lot of upside exposure. And you pass the risk on to someone else, and in return, you'll get less chance or less percentage of the profits. Typically, they say 3 to 8% of the profits is all you'll get in a licensing stream, which may very well be plenty for you.
Yeah, when you talk
it's
about...
It's a matter of what you're looking at going in.
Yeah, when
as
you talk...
an example, it's for some people, it's unfathomable to spend $50,000 or $100,000 or more, sometimes much more, to bring a product to market. They say there is no way they'll ever take that risk. And if that's true, and it's not a bad thing, but if that's true, licensing is a very good route.
Yeah, it all depends on your risk tolerance, and I know that the joke is that for the first-time entrepreneur that has a very high tolerance for risk, you can always tell them because the first thing they do is they go out and measure their garage to see how much product will fit in there.
Right, right. I think when first-time entrepreneurs are bringing a product to market or going through the process throughout any of the various channels, the biggest problem they face is finding out or determining when to spend money on something and when not to. And what I mean is there are thousands of different ways you can spend money bringing a product to market. People will help you do everything if you allow them to. And you have to figure out what things is worth spending the money on and what things are not worth it.
Yeah, and that's a tough decision. Well, Nick, this has really been great. How can our listeners get in touch with you if they want to make contact with you?
Well, they can call direct on a toll-free number, 888-322-9130, or they can access through the website, www.brannenlawoffice.com.
Okay. Well, this has been super. Well, thanks for being on the show today, and this has really been great, Nick. And our listeners
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our listeners have really gotten some great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch and their journey.
Yeah, thanks, Nick, for being on the show.
All right, thanks. Thanks again for having me.
Well, it's been another great show, Bill.
And I want to make a special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents and More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And tune in each week at this same time to listen live, or you can go to our website, thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com, and you can listen at your convenience. Until next week, this is Ron Reardon, Bill McHenry, signing off another great session of Launch.